This is the Lay of the Land with academic and deep thinker Luba Mayakiso.
Luba Mayakiso, a very, very good morning to you. How are you?
Very well, Howard, and glad to have you back. And I'm sure you ate far too much on your trip.
You know, luckily it's radio, so I know that you can't see me, and you're not saying that because you can, because you can tell.
I saw the pictures.
Yeah, sure. It was unbelievable. It was all about the food. But it was a really, really great trip to Israel. But of course, coming back to South Africa with the news that the city of Johannesburg passing a motion to change the name, obviously it's still quite far away from happening, but changing the name to Leila Khalid Drive. That's, of course, Sandton Drive, where the U.S. Embassy sits at number one, Sandton Drive. So that's going to be an interesting one. And then, of course, Hamas coming to South Africa and signing an MOU. We're living in absolutely bizarre times. All of this while the country's experiencing unprecedented load shedding. We've got crime rampant at the Global Citizens concert where people were harassed. We've got the economy that's floundering. It is just, it's just remarkable that we have the time to focus on these things. What's your thoughts?
Well, there's two perspectives. I suppose, yes, that will hold true, that we should be focusing on domestic issues. But it can be argued as well that, nations can't pause and focus on domestic issues only and forget about the world. I mean, I remember, for instance, listening to some fellow Africans a couple of years back when I was in Israel, who said, you know, they had grown up in Kenya and Nigeria, and countries were struggling, were poor. You're talking the 60s, 70s. But they still made time and donated money to South Africa towards fighting apartheid. So they will argue that even when they were in the midst of their worst crisis, they still found time to help, you know, the ANC, to help people in South Africa. So on the other hand, people argue, yes, you may be facing your own domestic challenges, but it doesn't mean that you put your blinkers on and forget about the world. So it's a difficult one to mediate, because both sides will hold true. Can nations just completely forget about their responsibilities? And I think what makes this one difficult is it's not so much who that we're helping, but who we're helping and the motives for our helping. That is what takes it more than anything.
Yeah, and also the fact that it's not as though they even had invited the Palestinian Authority. They've gone to the extremists. They've gone to people. I mean, at least the Palestinian Authority, as imperfect as they are, still maintain a facade of wanting a two-state solution, wanting to claim to want to live in peace with Israel. Hamas claim no such thing. They don't even pretend.
No, they don't. But the I think the strategy and the beauty of the strategy, I mean, I'm really not one to admire their strategy, but the success of the strategy of Hamas, the PA, and the whole Arab world has been to mask the real issues. Because even if you look at the meeting with the ANC, you know, Hamas was clear, we're not coming here to talk politics. We have no political interest to discuss. We're here to talk about a humanitarian crisis, and specifically medical. Mm. And that appeals to people's emotions. So they're able to almost mask everything and put aside their real aspirations and say, you know, we're living in terrible times and poverty and all of these issues. Now, I mean, just before we went on air, I looked at how much money they were getting. I mean, it's shocking. If you look at UNRWA, how much money they get, it is almost double. A Palestinian living in Gaza is getting more than double the nearest person who's getting any aid from the UN. So they aren't short of funds. But nobody's asking questions and saying, guys, come on, you're getting a heck of a lot of funding. What are you doing with it? So they come to us, and you know, it's a real tragic story of how many people have been injured in the conflict. They expect more people to be injured. So they appeal to people's emotions. And that has been working exceptionally well for them. And nobody's actually saying, but, you know, let's talk about the broader conflict. It's an interesting strategy that's bearing fruit.
So my question is this, and I try to put it to News 24 as well, but no one really takes it up. And that is why, if the ANC is either naive and let's give them the credit for that, and let's give them a little bit of credit and say they're naive, because we don't want to say it's malicious or corrupt or captured. If they're not asking the questions, why on earth isn't our press asking? When the ANC demand in May of this earlier this year that Israel withdraw immediately from Gaza, and a news agency like News 24 just simply repeat that demand and don't say, hold on a minute, Israel's not in Gaza. That's the real story. The real story is, why is our government so horribly ignorant as to what's going on around the world before they make a public statement? You know, we all laugh and mock Donald Trump when something's imperfect, but our ANC is doing this on a daily basis, and nobody's questioning it. And I'm perplexed as to why our media is not playing the role that they are charged with playing.
Let's be honest, Howard. I don't think anybody is naive. Maybe it's a combination. There might be an element of being naive about the true issues taking place, but there's also solidarity. I mean, the ANC always claims that they have this long-standing history of solidarity with the people of Palestine. Now, that goes back to the Cold War era. Now, solidarity, by definition, often means you don't look at the facts. You know, I stand with you because you're my friend. End of story. Now, you can do no wrong. Mm-hmm. We can go back to Mandela, who said Fidel Castro is his friend, Muammar Gaddafi is his friend, and he said the same thing about the Palestinian leader, Yasser Arafat. Now, the fact that most of them, all of them were dictators, made no difference because they were his friends. So that's the trouble with solidarity, is that you are my friend no matter what, and you can do no wrong. And publicly, I will never criticize you. So you've got, I suppose, an element of a lot of people not really understanding the conflict, that being naive. There's an element of solidarity that comes with it. And I think there is an element of being captured, because there's certainly enough money that flows into Africa from the Arab world to kind of influence people's perceptions. Now, the media is very interesting, and I cannot really explain to you why, because the media generally says nothing about our foreign policy, which is at best interesting. I mean, take the case of China and Tibet and Taiwan. Tibet is occupied. The media doesn't really raise that issue at all. Russia runs rampant through Crimea and parts of Eastern Europe, and the media says nothing. But what I do know personally is that it is very difficult to raise a balanced view about the Middle East conflict in South Africa. No media house will publish your story. So it tends to be very biased, and therefore one narrative prevails, one being that the Palestinians are occupied and that they are experiencing apartheid. If you write along those lines, you will get published. And I think South African media has taken a side when it comes to this issue. And the real tragedy is that not only has it become emotional, but it's almost been, has a cutoff point and been referenced. You know, I was chatting to somebody, I think last week, who was in the pro-Palestinian camp. And in our discussion, the person kept saying to me, no, we need to start in 1967 or 1948. So the history of Israel gets defined very narrowly in a way that serves the particular narrative. And there lies the difference. So if you challenge most journalists, and you ask them, do you understand the conflict? They don't. And I think people have been lazy to actually research and understand it. And they've been happy to accept the narrative that they're given, that we begin in 1967 when Israel takes back Jerusalem, or we begin with the partition plan, which people object to. So we have a very artificial history. And the crazy part is, we're in a country where we're very keen to go back as far as we can. I mean, when we talk of colonialism, we don't talk of 1948. We don't talk of 1913. As black South Africans, we're happy to go back to Jan van Riebeek landing on our shores. So it's almost a double standard that as a nation, we're happy to seek redress as far back as we can. But when it comes to this particular issue, for whatever reasons, and I think my view is ideological reasons, we only want to go back to a part that serves the interests of the Palestinians.
Yeah, and the other part of it that's perplexing is that South Africans should understand the connection to land. You and I have spoken about this. The whole issue of land reform in South Africa is absolutely vital to be solved if we want to move forward as a country and as a nation. But yet somehow a Jewish connection to the land is not taken seriously at all.
It's not taken seriously because my argument has been, I think there's been great deception, and in some heart, the Jewish community has allowed that deception to continue. I'm one that always advocates that, for instance, I've always said to people, I find it hard to talk about Palestinians because that's an artificially constructed kind of group of people, same as the West Bank. So very often in the discussions that we have, we use terminology that reinforces a particular narrative. So when you talk of the West Bank, you're not talking of Bethlehem. You're not talking of parts of Judea and Samaria. And I think there lies a problem, is that we engage in this discussion in terminology that the other side has constructed. Therefore, people are easily seduced. I mean, look at the ANC statement. Jackson Tambo says, as the ANC caucus, when they listened to the stories as the Hamas called it, Jewish occupation or Israeli occupation, people were filled with tears. They couldn't contain themselves because they relived their own suffering. And that is a strength of this narrative, is that it comes to Black South Africans and says, whatever you experienced, we are experiencing as well. We are occupied by colonial power that came from Europe and stole our land. So it doesn't require people to think. And Howard, we have to admit and say it's emotional. It pulls on the heartstrings and doesn't require people to think further. Those who will look further are those either who are deeply rooted in their faith or who are genuinely inquisitive to say, let me understand the facts. But the average person out there simply gullibly accepts the narrative given. So and that narrative doesn't look good for Israel.
34519, I'd love your thoughts on this, or 0618951019. I'm chatting to Luba Mayeki. So we're speaking about the situations that obviously has developed in South Africa, but the point that we're reaching is becoming, I think, very, very uncomfortable and is drawing the lines quite clearly as well. Luba, so your view, in terms of the Jewish community and the point that you make, I think is a very valid one. I think I believe the explanation that can be given for that, certainly I do it myself, is you try not to offend people too much. So you use the terminology the West Bank, even though the description is the West Bank of Jordan, which makes absolutely no sense. We use the term Palestinian, even though there was never a Palestinian people. So the West Bank is easy. We can talk about Judea and Samaria. What do we call this group of people that you're saying we shouldn't be calling the Palestinians?
Well, I mean, essentially, they admit themselves that they're Arabs who came from the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and some who came from Egypt. And I think we need to hold people to that as opposed to work around an invented narrative. You know, to me, it's not so much even the people, it's the geography. You know, in February this year, I was in Efrat, and the mayor, they welcomed me, and people talk of a settlement. And I said, why on earth do you refer to yourself as a settlement? It's not a settlement. It might be a village, it might be a town. But when you start using terminology
that they've defined,
the other side, a settlement is, you know, one settler, one bullet. You understand, right? A settler, absolutely. Somebody who came and took your land. So you need to assert that. I was posting on Instagram, and I'd been to Jericho and these places, and when I tagged them, I put Israel. And I know one good friend of mine who's very senior in the ANC research desk came back and said to me, that's not Israel, that's Palestine. And I said, no, there is no such thing. And I said, go and look at your Bible, go and look at history. So I will do that. It upsets people, but you have to challenge the narrative. You have to challenge, because in the Christian world, if you talk to Christians about Judea and Samaria, Jesus had a ministry mostly in Galilee, in Judea and Samaria. They know Judea and Samaria, but nobody knows West Bank. So if you cleverly move and shift things and talk of the West Bank, it doesn't resonate with anybody. So when somebody says to you, let's give the Palestinians the West Bank, Christians can't relate to that because we have no idea what the West Bank is. So you say, well, give it to them. Who cares? Now, but if you use terminology that people understand, and you say, but the West Bank is Judea, and then people say, no, hold on, I know that from the Bible. That's always been Jewish. So hence I'm saying we have to demand that people stick to these terms. The UN, for instance, will not refer to the Temple Mount. It will use another term. Again, when you argue about the Temple Mount, you're not using terminology we use. You use an Arabic name, and people don't understand what's the fuss. Let it go. So I think we have to be proactive and fight for the proper definitions, the proper names of these places. And in that way, then people become much more aware. But remember, people don't want this discussion. And the challenge we have, Howard, is you're trying to change a narrative where people are so embedded. Take, for instance, BDS now. They had a there was a chairperson of the ANC that I used to lobby here in Parliament. He was fairly, I mean, he was pro-Palestinian, but he was willing to listen to reason. But how do you explain a person going from an ANC chairperson of a portfolio committee to being literally a board member in BDS and being the spokesperson, interim spokesperson of BDS? The challenge we have is that you're trying to shape a discussion with people who are embedded, who already have taken very strong views, who in most cases aren't really willing to have a discussion about these issues. I've said so many times that when it comes to this conflict, many people in government do not even want to talk about Israel. It's a no-go area. So it's one thing to say I can change perceptions. But when a person says to me, Lube, we're not even having this discussion. Now, how do we make progress? Because it's a no-go area. And that's the crazy part, is it's the only conflict in the world that's a no-go area. You will lose friends, you will lose business, but let's not even discuss it. People have their views, and those views are wrong.
So tell me this, what do you, if you were advising, I mean, you often do advise the Jewish community, what would you say, has our approach been too soft? Are we trying to be too many things to too many people? Do we need, you know, I had somebody on the show yesterday that said, you know what, it's enough. South African Jews are have been very active in all sorts of areas. Maybe they need to stop with the charity work. Maybe they need to stop with the concept of tikkun olam. Maybe they need to say, hold on a minute, you know, you're invited people to the country that are openly advocating our death, and you are still expecting us to participate in this. It was Howard Saxton on radio yesterday, said Cyril Ramaphosa is a liar. Those were his words, because he said, you can't stand up at the Jewish Board of Deputies conference and talk about a relationship with the Jewish community with one face, and with the other face sign an agreement with Hamas who calls for Jewish murder. So what, you know, that was Howard's approach. He was angry yesterday. The Jewish Board of Deputies generally walks a very, very fine line between pushing, making sure that rights are protected, whilst not antagonizing anybody too much. What do you think our approach needs to be?
Without running into the risk of putting in a very religious head, but what I would say is tikkun olam is part of the Jewish essence. You can't do away with tikkun olam because the landscape tends to work differently. So what I would say is that in any conflict, whether it's a marriage, domestic, political, I always say remain true to yourself no matter what. Now, if part of the Jewish culture, the Jewish essence of being is tikkun olam, that you cannot change, that you should never shy away from and say, I will give less because I think I'm not appreciated, or I think that somehow politically our views are not factored. What I would argue, though, is that as much as Jewish people probably do more than anybody in the US and around the world, and certainly in South Africa, but a lot of that is unseen. And there lies the challenge. So what, say, for instance, those people that will oppose Jewish interests, their charity work will be much more visible. Because I think something that I find very similar in the Judeo-Christian world is that people tend to give, but they do it quietly. Mm-hmm. They don't kind of jump on a platform and say, I'm donating R1 billion or whatever. Now, the challenge with that is, whilst from a spiritual point of view, it might be very powerful and be very good and biblically correct, nobody knows what you're doing. So a lot of the goodwill that the Jewish community does in South Africa goes unnoticed. Now, I'll give you one example. Tune into SAFM and you've got an organization, Gift of the Givers. Now, Gift of the Givers will be everywhere. There'll be drought, there'll be a fire, they will be there. And it's unashamedly a Muslim organization. Now, it does work, but it gets almost support from the media, from SAFM and everybody else. So often, people tend to say, you've got a Jewish community that is very small to start off with, then their work is almost largely unseen. So you almost become irrelevant and unseen. And the question then, I suppose, is, which I really can't answer, should one then be more visible in the giving so that people are aware what is being done? Because, yes, the Jewish community is doing a lot of things. It's giving. But the average Joe Soap in public is not aware of that. So I would say tikkun olam certainly can't change. But I think we've got to find better ways to be able to point to the work that's being done so that people say, you know what, Jewish community is playing more than its fair role in this country. It's doing a huge amount of work. In terms of government, it's a difficult one because I do feel a lot of things, we keep telling ourselves that come the elections next year, the landscape will change, and perhaps the ANC or our president will be more emboldened to act more decisively. But at the same time, people are putting in place building blocks to really steer the ship the other way, that come the elections, we're going to be sitting with so many resolutions that the ANC has taken and these agreements with Hamas and everybody else that it's going to be very hard to undo. And I think there needs to come a time when I think we say to each other, if you're my friend, then there's certain things that I expect from you. Now, people don't like Donald Trump, but I've got to say I respect the Trump administration position of saying, if I'm doing X, Y, Z, and I'm donating funding to these countries and I'm doing this, and yet you have the nerve to stand and vote against me in public hearings, then I'm going to cut that funding and I'm going to send it somewhere else. So I think, you know, as long as politicians believe there is no consequence to double-crossing you or to voting against you, they will always do so. Now, that's the dilemma the Christian community finds itself in, because if government takes a position against the Christian community, there is no comeback, because we will never march, we will never do anything, and therefore government can say ignore. Now, this may sound, I don't want to like wade into the religions, but if you take Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, Judaism and Islam will be more vocal about issues that matter to their faith than Christians. Yet Christians number maybe 40 million. And politicians respond to that kind of pressure. So if you don't exert consistent pressure and you cannot punish a politician at the ballot box or in his pocket, then you are irrelevant. Now, the Jewish community might have clout financially, but doesn't have the clout in terms of numbers. And there lies the problem. Absolutely. But you have to be able to, I believe that you have to be able to say to somebody, if genuinely you are my friend, then I need to see your actions reflecting that friendship. In utterances. You can't come and meet with me and tell me that we're the greatest mates on the planet and then walk out and then go and sit with my worst enemy and then agree to things that are contrary to my goodwill.
Absolutely right. Luba Maikisa, brilliant analysis of the situation. Thank you. I really do appreciate it.